good evening to Europe, good morning to Asia, and good afternoon to those all across the fruited plains. You're now locked into the worldwide 20 megabit beacon of truth, hope, and justice, otherwise known as your weekly dose of the Crimson Pill. I, your host, the great and all-powerful Antonin Fiori, just make sure you don't peek behind the curtain, folks, encourage you to unfasten your seatbelts and turn on all portable electronic devices as we embark on the next voyage of the USS Crimson Pill. Our course has been charted for the Isle of Light by way of the Straits of Knowledge and the Sea of Tranquility. In the event of turbulence, the captain reminds you that your seat cushion is no substitute for an open mind. If you're seated in an exit row, you are now invited to move forward to our first-class cabin at any time. Ladies and gentlemen of the listening audience, welcome to the Crimson Pill.
And ladies and gentlemen of the BBSRadio.com listening audience, welcome to this Sunday, July 10th, 2011 edition and dose of the Crimson Pill. I'm your host, Antonin Fiori, and I am tentatively giving a title to today's show, NASA's Cover-Ups, Elenin's Friends, and the Truth About What's Heading Our Way. Now, one of the elements I had hoped to cover in today's program is a bit of research that your humble host has been conducting over the course of about the last year and a half, working on a book and working at getting this encapsulated, summarized into a presentation of sorts to make, and I'm calling that The Curious Case of Smedley Butler. Now, for those of you that are not familiar with the name or the case of Smedley Butler, he is, at the time of his retirement from the Marine Corps, he was a major general, and he was the most highly decorated Marine in U.S. history. Arguably, he may still be, if not the most highly decorated Marine, then certainly among the top few in the history of our military service. The case of Smedley Butler comes to mind to your humble host to share with you today because it is an exemplifier of the significance, the impact, and really the tragedy, folks, of the compartmentalization of information that we suffer under in this country today. What we think of as the United States, which should be the most democratic, the most open, the most transparent of governmental operations, is actually quite the opposite, and it's among the most secretive in the world's community of nations. The power, folks, of classified and compartmentalized information is how we must start today's discourse in the program. Your host is actually going to take you back in time to some of the topics that we've covered in past programs and that are very important and actually of keen interest to much of our listening audience. Today we'll be talking about Comet Elenin. And not just Comet Elenin or Elenine, tomato, tomato, folks. Your host calls it Elenin. We won't only be talking about what some folks consider a comet, but really, is it a comet, Elenin? But what might be more disturbing, alarming, perhaps, and of interest to us are the friends that Elenin appears to be bringing along with as it makes its way into the neighborhood of our earthly realm. We will talk about Comet Elenin and Elenin's friends. We will talk about secrecy, NASA's cover-ups. We will talk about recent announcements and disclosures that NASA has been making, not only with regard to Elenin, but with regard to extraterrestrial life, with regard to informational disclosures based upon their findings and their research that dramatically, drastically redefine what you and I had been taught for years and years. Well, really, it wasn't true teaching, folks, because they've actually held the true knowledge, the true understanding of these things. It's merely that us, the public, John Q. Public, you and I, after all, we're so unimportant as to receive these mere scraps from the table of knowledge and understanding and truth. We're so unimportant because all we do are pay the bills for their research, for their toys that they use and their findings, and as well as paying their salaries. That's all we do, folks. We're completely unimportant. We're too ignorant and we're too ill-prepared to handle the truth. Or are we? No, we're not. That's not my opinion, and it's why we have today's show available. Also on today's program, for the first time in Crimson Pill history on BBSRadio.com, we will open the phone lines to take your calls. I'm most eager, most anxious to touch base with the bbsradio.com and Crimson Pill listening audience. If you have been along for the ride over the course of the last month and plus, you've heard on our multiple episodes that we've had featured guests, including eminent researchers, incredibly respected in their fields of pursuit, folks like Mr. Jordan Maxwell, Dr. Brooks Agnew, Dr. Stanley Monteith, Dr. Joseph P. Farrell. And in the course of those discussions, we've had so much real estate to try to cover in terms of trying to get down to what the real truth is and why it's been hidden from us. Once again, those that only receive the scraps from the table, despite the fact that we're the ones that are paying all the bills and paying all those salaries, and we're getting no appreciation, no thanks, and in particular, no respect as a result of us making our commitment in that regard. Well, how do we begin this exposé? Yes, we will get to NASA, we will get to Ellen, and we will get to more of NASA's cover-ups and meta-disclosures. But I want to start by setting the table just to help some of you really understand the magnitude, the scope, the scale of how these cover-ups take place. Because, yes, I hear in the mind's eye cognitive dissonance ringing in the ears of many of our listeners. Folks who would prefer to believe that our government has nothing but our best interests at heart. Ladies and gentlemen, your host would prefer to believe that as well, and in fact spent the first X number of years of the host's life believing precisely that, that we live under this bastion of truth and hope and liberty that we call the red, white, and blue, that we're all in this together, that we're the best example of democracy ever known or seen on the face of the earth. Unfortunately, that's not true. Yes, this nation was set forth on the right path. Yes, our Constitution is the best example of what liberty can mean in the face of tyranny. But folks, in recorded human history, the pattern that we can receive and read and know to be the case is that tyranny is quite astute at rising and rising again, reconsolidating its power, attempting to resubjugate the citizens or the people in general to that tyrannical authority. And it has happened here in our own United States of America. How do I know this? Well, let's return to the curious case of Smedley Butler. S-M-E-D-L-E-Y is his first name. B-U-T-L-E-R is his last name. I'm thinking that I will not make a thorough exposition of this curious case of Smedley Butler on today's program, but what I will tell you is that this Major General of the Marine Corps at the time of his retirement, this man who had committed more than 33 years of his life, a man who, at the direct intervention of the President of the United States at the time, Calvin Coolidge, took a leave from his service in the Marine Corps of 2 years to be sent into and become an administrator for the city of Philadelphia with the express objective and intent to help try to clean up the corruption that was happening in that city. And after fulfilling that term of service at the behest of the President of the United States, he returned to the Marine Corps to finish his career. And at the end of his career, I do have to read for you how he stated in his own words. Keep in mind, a career military veteran that served not just with honor but with distinction, what you would consider to be a true red, white, and blue straight shooter. A man that didn't play ball with people who were allowing greed and self-interest to drive their agendas. That's why he was moved into Philadelphia in that role, is because he didn't play ball. He did not cave in to the money, to the temptations that the dark side so often serve up to those that they wish to pervert to their pattern on their agenda. No, instead, Smedley Butler was a true red, white, and blue American patriot and hero. And yet, by the time he reached the end of his career, in the course of his introspection and reflection on the geopolitical machinations that occur, not just at the scale of our national interest, but also in the world interest that it's so terribly interweaved with, I want to read for you the words that Smedley Butler used himself, this is a direct quote from Mr. Butler, to describe the actual or the ultimate value, maybe you want to call it the bottom line, of what his service wound up meaning. And folks, it's hard for me to read this without becoming emotional, becoming a bit choked up and a bit teary-eyed, but your host will make every effort to do so. I begin the quote. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service, And during that period, I spent most of my time as a high-class thug for big business, for Wall Street, and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico, and especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers from 1902 to 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Honduras right for the American fruit companies in 1903. In China in 1927, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was to operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents. Folks, that's difficult to hear. The words directly from this decorated and this honored veteran of the Marine Corps, Major General Smedley Butler, those words that he chooses himself to pose as the introspection and reflection upon the bottom line of what his service meant. It's tragic, but it's true. And ladies and gentlemen, you'll find that to be the case most often with the real truth, that it is not pleasant to look upon. It is not pleasant to face these truths, and yet we must, if we hope to make any genuine change. We hear the word change bandied about far too recklessly in this day. If we're to make the genuine change, ladies and gentlemen, the first step is to face these horrible, awful, and ugly truths. Now, the curious case of Smedley Butler becomes far more curious and far more chilling when you reach the end of his term of military service. And it involves the allegations of what is called commonly or popularly the business plot. If you do your homework, if you make a note of the business plot and also the name of Smedley Butler, you'll have a chance to begin to research his career. But if your humble host gives you just the highlights of this business plot, I will do so as follows. In November 1934, Butler alleged the existence of a political conspiracy of banking interests to overthrow President Franklin Roosevelt. Series of allegations that came to be known in the media as the business plot. A special committee of the U.S. House of Representatives was convened, headed by Representatives John W. McCormick of Massachusetts and Samuel Dickstein of New York. This McCormick-Dickstein special committee was a precursor to what became a standing committee for some time in the House, which was called the Committee on Un-American Activities. In November 1934, Butler told the committee that a group of businessmen, and you might also say financiers and bankers, saying that they were backed by a private army of 500,000 ex-soldiers and other recruits, a 500,000 mercenaries that had been recruited and organized by this grouping, intended to establish a fascist dictatorship in the United States of America. Butler himself had been asked to lead this army of mercenaries that would establish and enact this fascist dictatorship. In the interest of time, skipping ahead a bit in the course of this story, not only was it over 500,000 soldiers, mercenaries, that had been recruited to participate in this coup, but they were funded by a liquid $3 million that could be applied to the operational costs of this. In other words, they were already equipped, supplied, but with a liquid $3 million to use in the effort as well. I'm going to skip forward in time and in history here to the final report of the committee's findings. When the committee's final report was released, the New York Times, who had to sort of make a retraction of sorts of how they had characterized this story earlier in the process, the Times said that the committee, quote, purported to report that a two-month investigation had convinced it that General Butler's story of a fascist march on Washington was alarmingly true, and further, also alleged that definite proof had been found that the much-publicized fascist march on Washington which was to have been led by Major General Smedley Butler, according to testimony at the hearing, was actually contemplated. And I'm going to kind of conclude this introduction to this curious case of Smedley Butler by offering: the McCormick-Dickstein Committee confirmed that some of Butler's accusations in its final report were accurate. Quoting again, quote, "In the last few weeks of the committee's official life, it received evidence showing that certain persons had made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country." Folks, not just a fascist organization, but it was going to be utilized to attempt a coup. Continuing with the quote, "There is no question that these attempts were discussed, were planned, and might have been placed in execution when and if these financial backers deemed it expedient." Well, we know from history, or at least we think we know from history, that this coup did not take place, that we are not run by a fascist regime at this time. Although if we look around us and look at the headlines and understand things like how the TSA continues to grope children under 12 years of age, despite the fact that just 2 weeks ago they had said that it had become official policy that they would not, and yet just in the last few days a six-year-old was groped not once, but groped again, sent through the cycle once again. And we know not just the TSA, but the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, under Operation Fast and Furious, moving more than 30,000 firearms across the border into Mexico, into the hands of criminals, expressly for the purpose that it would generate a backlash and perhaps give them the authority to rescind the amendment to the Constitution that provides for the keeping of firearms among the populace, and that those orders did not generate at levels of mid-level leadership within the ATF or even senior-level leadership within the ATF. It's believed those orders came directly from the Oval Office. Folks, we'd like to think history tells us that we're not in a fascist regime, but ye shall know them by the fruits of their labors. Listen not to their words, look at their actions, look at their behaviors. Coming back to Smedley Butler in 1934, we can conclude that because the coup did not take place, because this fascist organization did not, in fact, march on Washington and make a military overthrow, we can conclude then that these financial backers did, in fact, receive what it was that they were looking for. If a mugger is mugging you on the street and says, "If you don't give me your wallet, I'll shoot you," if we skip the story forward 10 minutes and the person being mugged was not, in fact, shot, you can conclude that either A, they did, in fact, hand over the wallet, or B, they somehow subdued the attacker. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Smedley Butler told us himself that these attackers, these fascist organizers, were not subdued in any fashion. No, these financial interests, these global bankers, these international bankers that were behind this movement, and ladies and gentlemen, not behind this movement alone, they were behind the other fascist movements that took place in Germany of that era, in Italy of that era. The same international bankers that funded the geopolitical machinations occurring all over Europe and Asia in that window of time, not the least of which that led to the overthrow and to the unfolding of historical events in the Soviet Union. And your host wishes that we had hours in which to continue this exposition, but I would refer you to the work of authors like Jim Mars, like Joseph P. Farrell, who have made a very thorough exposition of the details, the twists, the turns of events, the historical figures involved, the windows of timing that point in tremendous authority and detail toward who was behind these machinations, and in fact it was the international bankers. Returning back to Smedley Butler, why is it that these folks did not deem it expedient to move forward with their plot? It's because they got what they wanted. And in this same window of time, in this early tenure of FDR's office, you will note that is the time of the Emergency Banking Act of 1934. Please make a note of that. Please do your own research. The Emergency Banking Act is when they closed all of the banks, what they called the bank holiday. No one was allowed to make withdrawals from their accounts. All holdings of gold among the American populace were confiscated by your government at that time. That's correct, confiscated. You were forced to turn in your holdings of gold, and if you did not, you were subject to the Trading with the Enemies Act. You were considered an enemy of the United States if you tried to withhold any of your gold holdings. This is the window of time when the Federal Reserve Bank took full authority, took full control. This is not made in the historical record, but this is the window in time when your United States government entered bankruptcy, in which it has remained to this day. And why don't you know this? Why didn't you hear this in history? Because the U.S. bankruptcy is considered a matter of national security. National security. It always returns to that, doesn't it? And the trouble with national security is that it is a precious few, and sometimes in the hands of just one individual who is allowed to make this determination that you don't get to know, because they think they know what's best for you. And that is what is wrong, folks, with America. Now, classification, national security, compartmentalization of information. Your humble host wishes to provide you with more examples of the power of compartmentalization. Let's turn our attention, for example, to the presidency of Give 'em Hell Harry Truman. Harry Truman, of course, was vice president under FDR, whom we just talked about, but not vice president for FDR's entire tenure. No, that was Henry Wallace for the first couple of terms of FDR's administrations. It was only FDR's final administration that Harry Truman was named to be his vice president on that ticket. And in fact, Truman had been vice president for only 82 days when President Roosevelt died on April 12, 1945. And folks, President Roosevelt was known to be in failing health for years prior to his death, but in particular in the window of months leading up to his death, his health was known to be in dire consequence. And so what I'm about to inform you about Harry Truman and about the power of compartmentalized information should resonate with you. It should give you some scale and scope of understanding about how NASA and these lies and cover-ups about extraterrestrial life, about the right functioning of our solar system, of our cosmos, of our galaxy, about so many of these other elements that they keep bound is in how it's made possible, how the truth has not made it to our ears. You see, shortly after taking the oath of office, Truman said in his first remarks to reporters, and I quote, "Boys, if you ever pray, pray for me now. I don't know if you fellas ever had a load of hay fall on you, but when they told me what happened yesterday, I felt like the moon, the stars, and all the planets had fallen on me." Now, President Truman there is not referring to hearing the news that President Roosevelt had died. What he's referring to are the briefings that he received when he had finally attained the level of classified information to be made aware of what was really happening and had been happening all around him. Part of that was the Manhattan Project. Those of you who are not familiar with the Manhattan Project, that's the title given to our course of research and development and testing leading up to the implementation, the deployment of the atomic weapons. The Manhattan Project is believed to have involved a scale of more than 130,000 people in its development. And so we're talking about senior military officials. We're talking about experts in their fields of physics, of the sciences that were employed. We're also talking about the blue-collar folks who constructed the facilities and the factories that were required for this project. The blue-collar folks who worked on the assembly lines and did the die casting and all of the other elements that were needed. Entire towns, villages were constructed for all of these people who were involved in the development of the Manhattan Project. The scope of the facilities involved ranged from Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, over, it's believed, into Arkansas and Alabama. Folks, we're talking about a tremendous scale of people involved in this project, and yet it is also believed that perhaps fewer than 20 people of that more than 130,000 had awareness of what the actual objective, the ultimate outcome, was to be. All of the others had their heads down and were focused on their individual pieces of this puzzle, and due to the magic and the wonder of compartmentalization, the ultimate truth was held in the hands of very few. And how few? Ladies and gentlemen, maybe you don't realize that even the President of the United States does not sit at the top of the pyramid, at the top of the totem pole of access to classified information. No, the President of the United States himself sits midway in the pyramid, midway on the totem pole. If that doesn't chill you quite enough, than the idea of how it is that Harry Truman, Vice President of the United States, one heartbeat away from becoming president at any moment, when all of the folks surrounding the administration knew that FDR's health was dire, that he was not long for the world, so to speak. Despite all of that, the determination was not made too brief to allow Truman any knowledge whatsoever of the Manhattan Project. That's right, one heartbeat away from the president and yet deemed not of a need to know, even in some of the basics of the elements of the Manhattan Project and its consequence. Folks, that is the power of compartmentalization. That is the power of slapping the label national security on something. And ladies and gentlemen, those people who have that power to do so, that can make that determination, sometimes in the hands of one single individual, as we watched President Nixon attempt to do, an attempt to sweep away the Watergate scandal by using that exact same technique and tactic, by calling it national security. Fortunately for the American people, at least in that window of time, members of Congress and the Supreme Court said, no, no, you will not be allowed to do that, sir. No, you do not have the power to do that, sir. And yet, as fortunate as we are that it was not allowed to happen in that window, ladies and gentlemen, it has been allowed to happen in so many of these other events that impact us in such a tremendous way. Another example, the Tuskegee experiments. If you were with us on the show a couple of weeks ago, you heard Dr. Stanley Monteith on the program as we talked about the Tuskegee experiments, as in Tuskegee, Alabama. T-U-S-K-E-G-E-E, if you're not familiar. That was a scientific research program conducted between 1932 and 1972 in Tuskegee, Alabama, in which 400 syphilis-infected black men were recruited by the United States Public Health Service. These participants were all told that they would be treated for their infections, but instead of being treated for their illness, all medicines were withheld. The black men were then actively prevented from obtaining treatment elsewhere, as their bodies and the bodies of their wives and children were systematically ravaged by disease. The United States Public Health recruited these subjects of the study, and the research program itself was conducted by medical doctors at hospitals, involving university staff, and also involving the tacit knowledge and awareness of, oh, as troubling as it is to believe, members of law enforcement who were recruited to help in this process of actively preventing them from obtaining treatment elsewhere. Yeah, it's difficult to contemplate, folks, that this type of systematic and calculated evil takes place, and yet it does. The Tuskegee experiment is just one other example for you to follow. You can take a look at Project MKUltra. You can take a look at columns of Army personnel, our dedicated servicemen, who were marched headlong into sites of radiation detonation and testing. Why? So that the effects of radiation on the human anatomy could be studied. And these folks were maintained as lab rats and studied through the course of multiple decades so that your military could see not just how the radiation affected them personally, but yes, you guessed it, how that radiation then went on to affect their offspring and their children's offspring. It is not easy to look at these subjects, ladies and gentlemen, but as we turn our attention back to Comet Elenin and Elenin's friends that are on their way, and so many of these other things that NASA has awareness of, and yet they only feed us the scraps from the table and give us these tiny bits of meta-disclosure, it is important to set the stage with that level of calculated evil that is easily kept in the dark and veiled from your eyes by virtue of compartmentalization of information, of classification of information, that disgusting label that I wish I could get the two words out of my head and lexicon, national security. It's important for you to understand just how powerful, how sweepingly dangerous it is to allow these people to sit at the top of that pyramid without us, the people, casting the light of day on their acts and on their behaviors and on their agendas. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm about to begin my discourse talking about NASA, what it's been up to most recently, giving you more examples of disclosures that NASA is trying to make between the lines. I call them meta-disclosures. But I do want to take some calls from the listeners during this program today, and so I want to give you the telephone numbers that you can call in. We have area code 530-413-4520. For those of you who are west of the truth, we have area code 530-413-4515 for all those of you living east of the truth, and we have 530-413-4511 for all those of you who are living south of the truth. And how about our folks to the north? Well, we also have a toll-free line. If you are in the U.S. or Canada, you can call this number toll-free, 888-260-3070. If you have thoughts on what your humble host has covered thus far, Harry Truman, the Manhattan Project, the Tuskegee experiments, compartmentalization of information, feel free to call in with your thoughts on those subjects. But also, if you are a follower of Comet Elenin, the information about Elenin's, some of the asteroids that are also in the presence and on their way this direction, feel free to make a phone call and be ready to share some thoughts along those lines as well. I will let you know it's probably going to be at least 10 to 15 minutes before we have a chance to take that first call, so if you want to wait just a bit before you make your call, you're welcome to do that as well. Now, on last week's program, we had set the stage with just a bit of the information about Comet Elenin, and I'd like to refresh some of this information and bring a few new facts and statistics to the table that I think many of you may not yet be aware of. First, Comet Elenin. For those of you who know little or nothing about it, Elenin is a most mysterious object. Is it actually a comet in the first place? Well, if you have not yet heard of the electric universe model of our cosmos, please make note of that and go and do a bit of homework. There's a website, the Thunderbolts of the Gods, that will make a bit of an exposition on this subject as well. There are those, in other words, who are finding the truth about the right functioning of our universe, of our cosmos, of our solar system, instead of this bunk that has been allowed to remain in our textbooks, both high school as well as university level textbooks, this bunk that NASA and that the Secret Space Program have been aware of the truth and the right functioning of these things for quite some length of time, for decades. And yet they have allowed these false paradigms to remain what we are taught in our textbooks because it is more convenient for them, and why else? You guessed it. For them to reveal and disclose the truth and make it public knowledge, they deem that to be a compromise of national security. They feel like by maintaining the truth about these paradigms and the right functioning of our universe, that that represents a bit of a competitive advantage that they might have over nation states, those both hostile and non-hostile as well. Comet Elenin, ladies and gentlemen, is mysterious. Mysterious because we have almost no photographic evidence of it. Mysterious because it was discovered by a Russian astronomer, Leonid Elenin, on December 10th of 2010, and yet no one has access to this astronomer. No one is able to interview him. Nobody even knows for sure, completely, if he actually exists. And yet there are other sources out of the Soviet Union that have made declarations that this quote-unquote comet Elenin appears to be demonstrating behavior to suggest that it is under guided control. That it is under guided control. Your host will leave that to sit for the moment as we continue to talk about Elenin. Another element about how it is unique is that it is traveling very much along the plane, the orbital plane of the planets in our solar system. Now, what does that mean? If you picture a tabletop, and at the center a large basketball that represents our sun, and each of the planets range in size from being marbles to baseball to softball or whatever the particular size is for each planet, most of them orbit around the sun along that flat plane as though they're rolling in orbital patterns on the surface of that tabletop that you've imagined. Most comets that come through our solar system make their way in a perpendicular fashion to that tabletop, as though you were dropping something from on top and it would hit the table but yet pass through, the plane of our solar system, if it could pass through that tabletop. That's kind of the fashion that most of these objects pass. It's uncommon for comets to travel right along the same plane that most of our planets are traveling upon. And when that occurs, it's not just that it's unusual and interesting. Because it's traveling right along that same plane, it can cause the most interference, the most engagement with those planets, either in a gravitational sense or, folks, more importantly, in an electrical sense. Because one of the things that has been kept from you, the truth that has been known by some parties, and they've known it based upon their research that was funded with our taxpayer dollars, one of those important truths, and the reason that I point out this notion of the electric universe model of our cosmos, is because there is a tremendous importance upon actual electrical relationships, not just between planets, but between the planets and the sun, as well as between these other objects which pass through the solar system, that we have misnomers about these objects. We think, for example, as comets, as being muddy snowballs, that they're largely ice and compressed gases and or liquids frozen into a snowball and covered with matter, so that it's like a muddy snowball flying through space, and eventually and gradually there are erosions made in the snowball, and that's what creates the tail of this thing. Please pursue some research on this notion of the electric universe model of the cosmos so that you can more accurately understand the truth of what these objects are, and that is to say that they are not muddy snowballs whatsoever. That these objects are actually asteroids, but the distinction between them and what we currently think of as asteroids is that these objects are charged bodies, whereas typical or quote-unquote common asteroids do not hold a charge. I don't want to dwell too deeply into that path because I want to continue our exposition of Elenin. Why is it important, folks? Well, first, it has demonstrated an intense orbital eccentricity. That means that it's not behaving nicely. It's not driving on a nice, straight, and narrow path as it makes its way through our solar system. Instead, it's twisting and turning. It's doing a lot of swerving. Is it guilty of driving while intoxicated? Well, we're not sure, but it is swerving rather recklessly. And in doing so, this orbital eccentricity makes it very difficult for us to accurately project what its trajectory will be as it continues along its path through our solar system. Now, I know that many of you are astute researchers. You like to see, touch, and feel some of this evidence yourself. It's why I will point you to www.nasa.gov, that's G-O-V, and from there, or even from your Google or Yahoo search engine, you can search for the JPL. That stands for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. You can do a search for the NASA JPL Small Body Database Browser. When you get to JPL's small body access, or their resources, their archives, part of what they have available are these orbit diagrams in which you're given a model, so to speak, of our solar system, of the orbital paths of each of the planets, and not just Comet Elenin, but any of these other objects that your host is about to speak upon. You're able to enter these into this tool provided by JPL, and you're able to make some manipulations of how you're viewing the model and seeing the trajectory path, as well as play this forward and backward like a DVD so that you can see the orbital path of these objects moving forward and backward for yourself. It's a very handy tool. If you have any interest whatsoever on these subjects, some of you have probably already seen this tool being utilized and uploaded to YouTube in various videos. I encourage you to go there yourself, folks. In particular, as I get into some of these details, not just of Elenin's orbital path, but some of its friends that it's bringing through the universe, or excuse me, through our solar system, and in particular, some of the dates that I am about to mention, because I'm about to give you, I hope your pen and paper are handy, some very specific dates of some windows of events that are coming up on us very, very quickly that I think it's important for each one of you to be more informed about. Continuing with Elenin, it's going to make its closest approach to our sun on the 10th of September, 2011. And by its closest approach, what we're talking about is it will make that turn around the sun, and in part due to the slingshot effect, the sun's gravity is going to launch that as it makes its continued trajectory, then leaving and moving away from the sun. It is believed by some that Elenin's orbital eccentricity, perhaps combined with what it does when it makes that turn around the sun, might make a further change or a further alteration to its projected trajectory. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important, folks, because on the 16th of October, Elenin is going to make its closest path to the Earth at only 0.23 astronomical units away from us. First question is, what is an astronomical unit? It is the name that's given to the distance between the Earth and the Sun. That distance is called one astronomical unit. So it will come within one-fourth of the distance between the Earth and the Sun on that date on October 16th. But folks, I know that you're telling yourself, well, that's quite a distance away. You're right, that's more than 21 million miles, but that is based upon their current projections of its trajectory. And once again, Elenin is not behaving nicely as it's making its path along the interstate highway of our solar system. It's swerving around erratically. We call it orbital eccentricity. Also, because Elenin has not been through here since what is projected to be 11,000 years ago, NASA has no way of knowing what Elenin's going to do when it makes its turn around the sun and begins coming our way, not to mention the fact of what it is caused and what occurs as it makes its way through Mercury's orbital pattern, as well as it makes its way across Venus's orbital pattern and makes its way toward the Earth. So it might very well come quite a degree closer than 0.23 AU. Only time will tell. And now, even if that is not the case, there's still more to this about why it's important, folks, in these dates and these windows. First, I had mentioned to you that date, that window of October 16th, when it is at its closest point to the sun. But what's important to know is that that closest point is about the moment, and if you go to JPL's tool, that small body database browser, you can see this for yourself. If you go to that tool, you'll notice that on that date, October the 16th, Elenin is basically crossing the path of Earth's orbit in front of us. And what that means is that in very short order, as we go through October 17th, 18th, 19th, etc., Earth winds up passing, based on its orbit around the sun, Earth winds up passing directly into the tail, the quote-unquote tail, if you still believe Elenin to be a muddy snowball. Once again, look into the Electric Universe model of cosmology. But Earth will be passing directly in what I would prefer to call the wake of Elenin. Its wake, if you think of any time you've maybe been out water skiing and some large boat passes in front of you at a tremendous rate of speed, you know what a wake is. The turbulence, the jet stream, however you want to refer to it, Earth passes directly through it by about the point, roughly the window of November 2nd and November 3rd. Probably the window is a little larger than that, folks. We're talking about large objects and we're talking about large ranges of effects. But I actually want us to roll our clock back far earlier than that in history, because there are some other significant dates and windows that are happening, ladies and gentlemen. And in the interest of time, I need to make my way through some of these dates and events in rapid fashion. I need to do it succinctly, so please take some notes along the way. If you're not able to capture all of these notes, please know that within 1 or 2 days, we will have uploaded this show to the Crimson Pill TV channel on YouTube, so you can go back and conduct some homework or make some notes in a more careful fashion based upon the YouTube upload, which should be up in a day or two. And also, we know that our good friend Dr. Brooks Agnew on his radio program, X Squared Radio, is a very diligent researcher and follower of these statistics as well. Dr. Agnew on his program last week was telling us about one of these friends of Elenin that we should be aware of. One correction to make in the information that he had stated a number of times is that the asteroid in question is actually not called YU-56, it is YU-55. But if you return to JPL's browser that I've discussed to you before, you can look that one up for yourself. The full name of that asteroid is 2005 YU-55. It's an asteroid. You can see its pattern exposited on the JPL small body data browser. And it is expected to make its closest point to the Earth at about November 11th of this year. And as Dr. Agnew so astutely pointed out, that window of timing is suspiciously? Coincidentally? No, not coincidentally. I don't believe that there's such a thing as coincidence in the world, but maybe suspiciously close to the testing date that the FCC has in mind for a test of the National Emergency Alert System, which is to take place on November the 9th. Once again, right when Comet YU-55 makes its closest pass in that window to the Earth. And YU-55, will its orbital trajectory, will its projected trajectory be altered by Elenin or by any of these other objects that I am once again about to discuss and alert you to? These other objects, folks, include an asteroid that has been known for a time as being a potential hazard to the Earth. Its name, its formal name, is 99942 Apophis. That's 99942 Apophis. APOPHIS. This is another object that you can use NASA's JPL browser to explore and to see its patterns. A bit about Apophis. Why is it important? Well, it is a near-Earth asteroid that caused a brief period of concern in December 2004 because initial observations indicated a small probability, at that time up to 2.7%, that Apophis would strike the Earth in 2029. Additional observations provided improved predictions that eliminated the possibility of an impact on Earth or the Moon in the year 2029. However, a possibility remained that during the 2029 close encounter with Earth, Apophis would pass through a gravitational keyhole, a precise region in space no more than about a half mile wide, that would set up a future impact on April 13th, 2036. This possibility kept the asteroid at level 1 on the Torino Impact Hazard Scale until August 2006. When the probability that Apophis will pass through the keyhole was determined to be very small. Not existent, not precluded, but the probability was determined to be very small. Apophis broke the record for the highest level on this Torino scale of impact hazard, being, for only a short time, a level 4 before it was lowered. Its diameter, its size, is about 270 meters. That's almost 3 football fields in diameter, 890 feet roughly. As of October 7th, 2009, the probabilities of an impact in 2036 are considered to be 1 in 250,000. Now, first of all, as to the course of these probabilities, what's important for you to know, and if you look up Apophis on JPL's small data browser, as well as Elenin, you can see that when we reach August 3rd, folks, that's only just a little over 3 weeks away, August 3rd, Elenin and Apophis are going to be right next door to each other, both of them right along that plane of orbital pattern that I described to you. Both of them right on the tabletop, both of them right next door to each other. And folks, with some of the projections, some of the speculation about Elenin and its perhaps its actual and true size, and as you look at some of this projections that we're trying to make about Elenin's true size, I'll just mention to you that as of the 21st of May, 2011, so just a number of weeks back, the coma of Elenin, the coma being that part of the quote-unquote comet that is supposed to be nearest and around the quote-unquote muddy snowball portion of it, so in other words, the coma would not include the tail of the quote-unquote comet, the coma has exceeded 100,000 kilometers in diameter. That is multiple times the size and the diameter of the Earth itself. Now, is this coma just simply debris and exhaust the exhausting of gases and small bits of matter? Or is this, in fact, the diameter of the actual object itself? Is it really an asteroid that is really 100,000 kilometers in diameter? It would be fantastic if we know, folks, but we're not being given any scraps from the table from NASA as to these points. You know, NASA works overtime to give us all kinds of details about the least interesting of objects in our solar system, and yet they've given us only the meagerest of scraps from the table in relation to Elenin. And as a result, NASA, when you leave us in the dark, we're left to have to come to these forms of speculation to try to fill in the gaps. Those of you at the top of the pyramid, NASA, there are those in the public. There are those outside of your hallowed halls who know what your agendas are, who know what you're about, who know who some of you are that sit at the top of the pyramid. And Administrator Charles Bolden, for example, is not one of the folks that sits at the top of the pyramid. He is not deemed to have a need to know, ladies and gentlemen, for the most important findings. And quite frankly, to put it in perspective, NASA itself, 99% of the employees, whenever they hear comments like those being made by your humble host right now, they're quick to diminish them. They're quick to chuckle and laugh and say, these things aren't true. We don't know this. Ladies and gentlemen, that's exactly what senior scientists in the Manhattan Project wanted themselves to believe. They wanted to believe that because they held multiple PhDs and because they were considered to be among the top handful of experts in their particular fields of research, they also loved to believe the fact that if there was something really going on, that they would know. And in fact, folks, they didn't know in the Manhattan Project. They didn't know in the Tuskegee Project. They didn't know in MKUltra. And 99% of you in NASA, you don't know either. If you'd like to find out, keep listening to the Crimson Pill. Administrator Charles Bolden is only midway down the totem pole. So who do you ask, listening audience? Who do you ask is it, then, that sits at the top of the pyramid? Well, most of those folks are in the military, and most of them are part of the space program, but the secret space program, the black space program, the space program that had been in operation long before the official charter and formation of NASA, which took place with the National Aeronautics and Space Act of 1958, which I have a copy before me, and I've made a very thorough exposition of the sections and the precise elements of the Space Act, which allows for this compartmentalization of information, which allows for the regard of any of the most significant findings to be instantly considered classified, because in those regards, that type of information and finding, those are held in the exact words located within the Space Act. In those cases, NASA is deemed and treated as a defense agency, specifically for, once again, ladies and gentlemen, sing the two words with me, national security. So yes, there is a top of the pyramid involved with NASA, but yet NASA itself, from its administrator on down, they sit a notch below the top of that pyramid. Usually when you're hearing me yell, folks, about NASA, in point of fact, you're hearing me yell about our secret space program, the one that we pay for, but the one that we're not even fed the most humble scraps from the table of what they have found and of what they know. But we will continue to shine light on that. We turn our attention now back to asteroid Apophis. And on August 3rd of this year, go to NASA's JPL and their resources, you'll see Apophis and Elenin are right in each other's backyards. And if Elenin turns out to be the size and the scope that it is speculated based upon the measurement of its coma to be, it may very well cause a gravitational relationship to occur, an alteration of Apophis's trajectory course that could throw all of these estimations that have been made in the past about Apophis's trajectory, could throw them all out the window. Why would that be important? Why would it be important for us to know or wonder about what Apophis might mean to us? Well, here's why, ladies and gentlemen. The possible impact effects of Apophis if it struck the Earth. The initial estimated energy, and you have to keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that so much of this estimation about its impact is based upon the speed, the velocity at which this object is coming in. Once again, if Elenin and or if the precarious balance, the dance of the effects of Elenin and or our other planets in the solar system cause some of these changes in the trajectory of Apophis, it might very well affect the velocity, the angle of incidence at which it makes its entry into Earth's atmosphere. It could have effects on all of this. It is a multivariate equation. There are multiple variables involved. But the initial estimate that NASA provided as to the energy that Apophis would release if it struck the Earth was the equivalent to 1,480 megatons of TNT. 1,480 megatons of TNT. Now, let's give ourselves a little bit of context here first, quickly, to understand just what magnitude that is. The biggest hydrogen bomb ever exploded, called the Tsar Bomba, was around 50 megatons. The largest hydrogen bomb ever exploded, the Tsar Bomba, was around 50 megatons. That's right. So NASA's initial estimate of the energy Apophis would release if it struck the Earth, yeah, if you're doing the math correctly, you're right, 30 times the equivalent of the Tsar Bomba at 1,500 megatons. Now, NASA later provided a refined estimate of 880 megatons, and then they further provided another revised estimate of 510 megatons. Well, you know, folks, history has shown us that due to our old friend, national security, and the compartmentalization of information, that sometimes, unfortunately, someone who stumbles upon the truth, probably the initial NASA researcher that provided the initial estimate, those revisions that come down the pipelines are revisions that are made in order to misinform, to disinform, to obfuscate, and to confuse. And so whether their further refined estimates are closer to the truth or actually going in the opposite direction, we can never know. And NASA, once again, if any of you are sitting there and chuckling as to why someone could be so skeptical, it's because you never stop lying. And again, your humble host should remind himself, I should not direct as much of my venom to NASA as I do. I may as well start calling it and referring to the true top of the pyramid, the secret space program, as what it is. Because again, from Administrator Charles Bolden on down the stream of the fine American citizens, scientists, researchers, blue-collar folks that work for NASA, I don't question your integrity, folks. I don't impugn your integrity. I merely say that you're so far down the pyramid that often you probably are misled even by your own administration as to what you actually know and don't know. And again, if you doubt that, why don't you ask, if you could, President Harry Truman, what it was like to find out about the Manhattan Project, not even in the final days of FDR's life when his health was more on a lifeline than what is also made publicly knowledgeable. Why don't you ask Harry Truman what it was like to find out about the most powerful weapon known to mankind, and that he, the vice president, who was one heartbeat away from the office of the presidency, was not informed of it to any extent whatsoever until he had taken that oath of office, which had elevated him a few more notches up the chain of command, up the pyramid, up the totem pole, in terms of his access to that compartmentalized information. And even though it took him a few more notches up the chain, folks, it was still a long ways from being at the top of the pyramid. Returning now to Apophis. What else is significant about Apophis, you might ask? Well, Apophis, that name, Apophis itself, it's the Greek name of the ancient Egyptian enemy of Ra, or more correctly pronounced, Re. When you've heard Amun-Ra or Amun-Re, that's who we're talking about, folks. Apep, the enemy of Re. Apep, the uncreator, a serpent that dwells in the eternal darkness of the Duat, or Earth's middle, and tries to swallow Re during his nightly passage. Apep is held at bay by Set, the ancient Egyptian god of chaos. Apophis, the destroyer. Now, you'll hear the surface-level stories that are provided, which tries to give you some reason as to how NASA gives these intriguing names to all of these objects. And the surface-level stories usually say that so-and-so and such are fans of television shows or science fiction, or they're fans of ancient history. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that might be interesting if there were more evidence in the record of how some of these missions, how some of these objects were being named after elements from history that get outside of the range of antiquity, that get outside of the range, in particular, of Egyptian history, as well as that from Greece and Rome, much of whom their pantheon of gods and the events that took place, the tales of the Titans and the myths themselves, stemmed from that older history that runs to this chain of Egypt of antiquity. And if you have heard your humble host's radio program, The Crimson Pill, as broadcast on Republic Broadcast Network, or RBN, you've also heard an exposition that has been made to this effect, dealing with exactly some of the extent of NASA's cover-ups and these ties to these dubious sets of naming dating back to Egyptian antiquity. In particular, you may have recall or have heard me make the connection before about one mission that's coming up in particular that NASA has named OSIRIS-REx. I want to cover this just again in case some of us have not made this journey before together. I'm reading now from a media advisory on www.nasa.gov, that's G-O-V, dated May 25th, 2011. The title of the media advisory is NASA to Announce New Planetary Science Mission. The dateline is Washington. It says NASA will host a media teleconference at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Wednesday, May 25th, to discuss the selection of a future science mission that will usher in a new era in planetary exploration. Your host has added the emphasis to the end of that sentence. Let me do so once again. A new era, which in and of itself is a phrase given to esotericism and occultism. Those of you who are not initiates in various secret societies don't understand the full significance of when that phrase is employed. A new era in planetary exploration. Now, the full text of the article itself released to support that media advisory is also found on NASA.gov. It is also dated May 25th, 2011. And that title is NASA to Launch New Science Mission to Asteroid in 2016. NASA will launch a spacecraft to an asteroid in 2016 and use a robotic arm to pluck samples that could better explain our solar system's formation and how life began. The mission, called Origins Spectral Interpretation Resource Identification Security Regolith Explorer, they've given it the acronym OSIRIS-REx, will be the first U.S. mission to carry samples from an asteroid back to Earth. They call the mission OSIRIS-REx. If you have some grounding in ancient Egyptian culture, you will know that Osiris is not a pharaoh. Osiris was considered and worshipped as a god. If you have familiarity with the Latin language, you will know that the word Rex in Latin means king. They are naming this mission Osiris the King. Ladies and gentlemen of the listening audience, that is wrong on more than one level. And let's start at the surface level. Let's start at the easiest one for us to think about in our day-to-day life. If NASA had chosen to name this mission something like Jesus the Savior or Christ the King, or if they had chosen to name it something along the lines of Allah the Holiest, Allah the Greatest, Allah the King, there would be not only a public outcry, but you would also have multiple organizations and interests within the United States, take for example the ACLU, that would stumble all over themselves in an effort to make an injunction and to force NASA to rename the mission. There is, after all, supposed to be some separation between church and state. And NASA and this mission and all those salaries being taxpayer-funded, there should be this distinction being made. That is the reason why there would be such an outcry, such a hue and cry made, if it were to be named Christ the King. Well, folks, there are those who continue to worship these pantheons of gods from antiquity. There are those who make ritual practice of these things. For more information on this, I would point you in the direction of Richard C. Hoagland and Mike Barra in their book, Dark Mission. Also, the website of Richard Hoagland, enterprisemission.com, where you'll find numerous white papers that have been made with a very careful exposition in great detail of the ritual, careful planning, for example, of the Apollo missions, the moon missions, when launches were scheduled based upon which astronomical configurations were in the sky, which constellations were coming up over the horizon, And not just launches, but also the exact windows of the landings that took place on the lunar surface, timed, coordinated to take place in a ritual fashion to when these constellations were in the sky. And folks, I say constellations plural, but let's narrow it down to the chief one that all of this timing seems to have built around. It is the constellation of Osiris, which for some of you who, again, maybe have familiarity with astronomy or cultures from antiquity, you realize there are the connections made between the constellation of Orion, excuse me, I think I misspoke a moment ago, the constellation Orion, and that of the personage of the god Osiris. If not, you've got the names, make a note, please do some research, and you'll know even more about why it is that I'm offended that NASA would choose to roll with the acronym Osiris the King, Osiris Rex, translating to Osiris the King for this mission. You also should be outraged. www.nasa.gov, if you do a search or just look through the menus, you should quickly be able to find and get to the Public Affairs Office, the contact information for NASA's Public Affairs Office. And if you are a taxpaying citizen, particularly if you are a Christian of any denomination, or if you are a Muslim, or if you are Jewish, or Hindu, or Buddhist, particularly then, you should be offended and outraged by this, that your taxpayer dollars are worshiping a god for the title of this mission. And even if you are agnostic or atheist, I would also think that you would be offended by this. Folks, this is not mere quaint representation of these symbols from antiquity. It might seem that way at the surface, but again, Dark Mission or EnterpriseMission.com, the book Dark Mission, the website EnterpriseMission.com, and many other researchers in the field have made a very careful investigation as to the timing and the sequences, and there are no such things as coincidence. There is a great deal of ritual and occult practice that has been put into place associated with each of these missions and the research conducted by NASA. And I return now back to this mission, and I tell you that there is another layer of this which bears your further investigation as well. You see, they're naming this mission Osiris the King, and they're saying that this mission to go to this asteroid could better explain our solar system's formation and how life began. By taking this sample from this asteroid, they're saying not just understanding our solar system's formation, but how life began. And I now return your attention back to what the media advisory said about this mission, to discuss the selection of a future science mission that will usher in a new era in planetary exploration. A new era in planetary exploration. It continues to refer to that in the body of the article itself discussing this NASA mission. Now, why is that important? Why should that be a sore thumb that sticks out? Well, because, folks, in the month that we're in the calendar right now, there's a NASA mission that is on its way to an encounter with an asteroid called Vesta. It is NASA's Dawn probe, which is now just roughly 96,000 miles away from the asteroid Vesta, which is the second largest object in the main asteroid belt located between Mars and Jupiter. NASA officials announced today, this article is dated June 23rd. It is found in space.com. It was published June 26th. I apologize. The article was published June 26th on www.space.com. The author is Mike Wall, W-A-L-L. Title of the article, NASA Readies for July Encounter with Massive Asteroid Vesta. They talk about the Dawn probe, and folks, you'll notice they didn't have to name this probe after any god from some other religion from antiquity. They didn't name it Zeus. They didn't name it Jupiter. They didn't name it Saturn. They didn't name it Osiris. NASA's Dawn probe. Do you see what you're capable of, NASA? You can spend our taxpayer dollars along in conforming to the standards and the practice of separation of church and state. You are capable of it. But further, folks, and time precludes me from making a detailed exposition of this article, at no time in here do they refer to this as planetary exploration. No. right from the title of the article itself and continuing all throughout the course and the base of the article, they call Vesta exactly what it is, an asteroid. Why is it that they call this asteroid that Osiris the King mission has been launched to try to explore? Why is it that they refer in vague terms to that as being planetary exploration? Unless perhaps they know some things about this mission, its extent, its consequence, and its significance that we don't yet know. And oh, by the way, Osiris the King, yes, you can tell your humble host is more than miffed about the naming of this. Folks, when you spend more than $800 million, $800 million, on these toys involved in this mission, and when I'm paying for your salaries, you damn well had better not call it Osiris the King. You can fire up your word processors and you can send some new work to your printing presses and find a different name for it. NASA, I pity how it is the place of consciousness that some of your operational decisions come from. Folks, here in just a bit, we're going to turn our attention to an interview that was pre-recorded for this program, an interview with a subject matter expert. His name is Mr. Jan Irvin, and it's a bit of a departure from this subject matter that we've covered thus far. But I need to return our attention not just to comet, quote-unquote, Elenin, not just to the asteroid Apophis, not just to the asteroid 2005 YU-55, I also need to bring your attention quickly to the presence of what is called Comet Honda, or it's known by its official title of 45P, and there's also Levy, L-E-V-Y, its official name, P/2006 TI. All of these objects, I generically refer to the grouping of them as Elenin's friends, all of these objects bear your further investigation and bear the time and energy required for you to inform yourselves of their presence, of the manner and fashion in which they might be interacting with one another as they make their way through our planetary neighborhood. In the course of this, I also need to talk about how it is that none of these objects might have any impact on us. That's right, you heard me. It is actually the opinion of your humble host that none of these objects is going to result in or cause what you would consider to be the end of the world. None of them. I don't believe that to be the case. I do believe that one or more of them may cause problems for us, but problems that will not result in being the end of the world, quote unquote. Here's another example. Elenin, when it slingshots past the sun, will it remain intact? Will it be broken into fragments, as we saw the comet Shoemaker-Levy do before it impacted one of our planetary fellows some number of years back, when it hit the ripples of the gravitational field of that body, when it began to fragment, to split into multiple objects? Perhaps Elenin will do that when it makes its pass around the sun. Perhaps one or some of these fragments will cause these issues. If you check out the YouTube channel or these archives located on bbsradio.com, you'll find an interview I conducted a couple of weeks back with a researcher named Mr. Ali Adams, who is trained in information technology, has a master's degree that has led him into a career in the software industry where he is specialized in cryptography, which is the encoding and decoding of information, and his work using prime numbers, where he's conducted research in the text of the Islamic holy book, the Quran, which has led him to project that there will be 31 different events that we face, each event lasting 4 days in length, beginning on January 7th of 2012. And these 31 events scattered out along the road until we reach November of 2012. Yes, these events might very well pose significant issues for us. But in talking about Elenin, Apophis, YU-55, Honda, and these other objects, we have not yet broached the subject of the source and cause of events that could have tremendously significant impact on us and life on Earth, that your humble host does believe is more probable to be the source of these events, and that is our own sun. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, our own sun. We have all heard about solar flares. We've heard about what are called CMEs, or coronal mass ejections, which take place. In fact, just over a month ago, or in the neighborhood of a month ago, there was a very large coronal mass ejection that took place, which was not pointed directly at us. In fact, the Earth was only going to be in the path of a peripheral bit of the energetic expulsion made from this coronal mass ejection. And yet, even being on the periphery of it, even catching, in other words, only a bit of the shrapnel of this, it still had the potential to pose enormous problems here on the face of the Earth. And what I would like to point out for you now, as I talk more about solar flares, is the example that NASA's Administrator Charles Bolden has made multiple informational releases internally to NASA employees and contractors along the lines of family and personal preparedness, including the memo that I quote from now, dated Friday, June 10th, 2011, the agency-wide message to all NASA employees, family and personal preparedness plan. NASA is the only federal agency responsible for its people's safety and well-being here on Earth and in space, and has a long-time commitment to safety and emergency preparedness. Over the past year, Administrator Bolden has emphasized the importance of family and personal preparedness for the entire NASA family. Family and personal preparedness plans are key to protecting our families and communities during potential emergencies such as fires, floods, earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, terrorist attacks, and other unforeseen catastrophes. Now, yes, this information comes directly from NASA. They're warning their people to step up, to ramp up their efforts at personal preparedness. I also bring your attention to what is called the National Security and Homeland Security Presidential Directive, NSPD 51, or the Homeland Security Presidential Directive, HSPD 20, sometimes simply called Executive Directive 51, which was created and signed by President George W. Bush on May 4, 2007. And this directive claims power to execute procedures for continuity of the federal government in the event of a catastrophic emergency. Such an emergency is construed as, quote-unquote, any incident, regardless of location, ladies and gentlemen, that results in extraordinary levels of mass casualties, damage, or disruption severely affecting the U.S. population, infrastructure, environment, economy, or government functions. Now, please pay careful attention. The unclassified portion of the directive was posted on the White House website on May 9, 2007, without any further announcement or press briefings. Oh, yes, the power given to one single individual to they themselves make the declaration of a catastrophic emergency without having to consult with Congress, let alone receive an act of empowerment from Congress. At the stroke of a pen, one single individual has the right to make this declaration of catastrophic emergency. And folks, it can be done over something as simple as a coronal mass ejection, which can have a horrendous and tremendous impact on the Earth, as you will find if you do your research on something that was called the Carrington event, Carrington, the Carrington event of September 1st, 1859, which is regarded by some as the largest coronal mass ejection in history. It was 11:23 a.m., just before dawn that day. Skies, just before dawn that day. Before dawn, skies all over planet Earth erupted in red, green, and purple auroras so brilliant that newspapers could be read as easily as in daylight. Indeed, stunning auroras pulsated even at near tropical latitudes over Cuba, the Bahamas, Jamaica, El Salvador. Even more disconcerting, telegraph systems worldwide went haywire. Spark discharges shocked telegraph operators and set the telegraph paper on fire. Even when telegraphers disconnected the batteries powering the lines, aurora-induced electric currents in the wires still allowed messages to be transmitted. Now we know that these solar flares happen frequently. And yet, if they were to happen in today's era, it's estimated that a Carrington event size occurrence could result in trillions of dollars of disruption, knocking out satellites, disrupting computer telephone communication as we know it. Ladies and gentlemen, I have to drop this thread for now. We'll pick it up next week. Please begin to do your investigations on coronal mass ejections. Just now, I want to turn our attention to what each one of us can do. This interview with Mr. Jan Ervin, we will explore the subjects of what each of us can do to educate ourselves so that you begin to see through and read between the lines of these meta-disclosures that they make, these cover-ups, these lies that they make. Mr. Jan Ervin is about to tell us techniques that we can use and better understand to see through their lies, to shine light on the truth. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me next week, but for now, tune in to our interview with Mr. Jan Ervin. And ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to introduce our next guest, an individual that I heard as a featured guest on Alex Jones' show quite recently. His name is Mr. Jan Ervin. An author, researcher, and in my opinion, an original thinker, which is rare in our times. He's an author of at least two books, and I'm going to ask Mr. Ervin if he'll help make a more thorough introduction of himself. But just before we do bring him into the program, you can find his work at www.gnosticmedia.com. Describes as pulling helping to pull us outside of the box and into the heart of cognizance itself, where the word Gnostic in this sense pertains to knowledge, not necessarily the dogmatic Gnostic teachings. Gnostic, of course, as so many of the folks in the listening audience already know, has its origins in the word knowledge, gnosis, in other words, from the Greek, or to know. His topics of investigation include education and the seven liberal arts, including or comprised of the trivium and quadrivium, which I think is one of the subjects we'll be largely focused on in today's interviews. Mr. Ervin, are you there?
I'm here. Welcome. And by the way, I should just say real quick so that people can find it, Gnostic is spelled with a G, GNOSTICmedia.com.
Absolutely. And I think once folks make their way there, and so many of the folks in our BBSradio.com listening audience keep multiple browsers open during the course of their listening to the shows, so I hope that they're already on their way to www.gnosticmedia.com. Mr. Ervin, welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
Good, thank you.
Good. Well, I had mentioned that you are an author of at least two books, from what I've been able to ascertain.
Right, and working on a couple of other book projects right now as well.
Fantastic. Maybe we'll have a chance to kind of return and revisit to some of that through the course of our interview. I very much appreciate your availability on such short notice, but upon hearing your interview on the Alex Jones Show, I knew immediately that you are an ideal guest to bring to the program, because today's program really involves the process of awakening, you know, and so I think the term is thrown around too loosely.
I think that's definitely so. In fact, I would say, you know, much of what people think is waking up out there is, in fact, a lot of mind control stuff, and so that's it's very important to bring a lot of that to light. The Fabian socialists have been very tricky in how they've manipulated the New Age movement.
I think you're quite right, and in fact, maybe you could sort of begin our discussion by talking a little bit about the Fabians. For some folks out there, they may not be familiar with the Fabian Society.
I haven't even studied a great deal on it. My business partner, Richard Andrew Grove, he's done a lot more research on it than I have. But I know they were tied in with the Theosophists and with Madame Blavatsky and with other groups. And they're basically trying to push a socialist world agenda over everybody through means of bringing down the major ancient religions, which are also systems of ancient mind control, and trying to impose their own, which basically subverts family values, subverts traditional religious values, and creates this individualistic, typically positive thinking, which is usually inaction, right? It's I know a lot of positive thinkers that refuse to take any action whatsoever when they see a wrong being done, and they'll say, oh, well, you just need to think positive, or somebody else will come and take care of it. You know, this whole sort of mentality, these are all things that have been done to by the Fabian socialist types, which includes, you know, people like Alice Bailey as well. And they, you know, they had an impact on education and things like that as well. But so, you know, that's really... See, I kind of consider in many aspects, not in all, and I'm certainly not trying to throw out all New Age beliefs just as a blanket dismissal, but certainly the New Age movement has been largely subverted by people who are less than genuine in their promotion of ideals and the things that are results of them. Just real quickly, about a year and a half ago, I had Dr. Barbara Ehrenreich on my show, who's the author of a book called Bright Sided, how the relentless promotion of positive thinking has undermined America. And, you know, there's an old saying, I forget exactly how it goes, I'm going to try and reiterate it, but there's an old saying, if you have somebody negative, somebody who's not negative or positive, and somebody who thinks only positive in a race... who would win the race?
Uh-huh.
let me ask you, just go ahead and answer that, see if you can answer it.
Well, I would begin by saying I don't think it's the person that only thinks positively.
Well, it's kind of a joke, but here's the funny thing, is the negative person, he starts off the race, he's complaining about everything, doesn't stop to smell the flowers or whatever, you know, the guy who's not positive or negative.
Sure.
You know, he's not being negative. He is stopping to smell the flowers along the way or whatever. He's having a good time. Well, you know, basically the idea is that those two finish the line at the same time. But the positive thinker is so upset by the negative thinker that the positive thinker sits down to meditate to clear the negative energy before they start the race, and they never finish it.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is something that we have to keep in mind, and Barbara Ehrenreich really makes this issue poignant in her book, which is why I had her on my show. And if you study the Kabbalah, you have to realize that it's all about balance. You know, you have a balanced diet. You want to have a balanced life, a balanced, mental capacity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Balance is good. When things are out of balance, they're off balance, and they typically crash or don't function properly. So we want to have balance.
Quite
and that's
right.
Really the key is not being overly positive or overly negative. You don't want to be around somebody who mopes around all day long, can't accomplish anything, and has a pity party either. You want somebody who's able to take action, able to get things done and accomplish things.
Sure, sure. It's some of the sort of thinking that might remind some of our listening audience of from Buddhism, the middle way, the path of balance.
Yeah, exactly.
Understanding that the world is not inherently good nor inherently evil.
Exactly, that's exactly right. You know, and you know, there's Shiva and Vishnu, the creation and death. There's, you know, try and live without killing something, right?
Yes, yes.
Whether it's a plant or an animal, I mean, some people claim that they can live off just the sun's energy or something, but I don't know if that's true or not. I haven't seen personal evidence of it myself. I'm not saying it's not possible, and certainly a lot of people promote that idea, but pretty much if you're alive, you're eating something, and therefore you're killing something to stay alive, and that's how it goes.
Quite right. Quite right. Well, you know,
and when we accept that fact, that's really where peace comes in.
Yes. And I think so many folks today, once again, the term awakening is used too loosely, in my opinion. And yet, I think it is fair to say that so many folks on a daily basis now are becoming acutely aware of what is happening. The man's inhumanity to man, the horrific decision making that seems to be driven by greed and lust for power. In that process of folks trying to sort out what is really happening in this world, some folks refer to it as the matrix or the mind control grid or the programming grid that's being imposed by some folks. Some folks use the term the elites or the powered elite or the New World Order. without trying to get caught up in all of those terms, Mr. Irvin, what I would like to do is talk about your research and your work and some of the information or the steps that you point to in terms of helping people begin to see, to realize how pervasive some of these control mechanisms are around us in society, in culture, some of that programming that is maybe keeping us from being more aware of what is happening. And I think that some of that work, you would point toward the trivium and quadrivium as being essential in that regard. But I wonder if you'd respond or comment along these lines.
Well, sure. I think the trivium and quadrivium are absolutely essential in people's waking up. If we go back to Roman times, the Romans did not allow slaves to study the trivium and quadrivium. What the trivium and quadrivium are is what is commonly known as the seven liberal arts. And these are called the seven liberal arts, and the word liberal is a very interesting word. Today it has many negative connotations against it, like communist, anti-freedom, tax and spend liberals, all of this type of thing, Democrats. But these are all things that are actually the antithesis of what a liberal really is. A liberal, by definition, is somebody, the definition is of or befitting the free. And where the word comes from is the Latin word liber, which is where we get the word book from. Uh-huh. And so there's been an intentional effort to actually twist the meaning of the word liberal around to make it into its antithesis. When you hear all of this rhetoric against liberals in the mainstream corporate media, the last thing you want to do is go study a liberal arts education and find out what that's all about.
Mm-hmm.
So when you discover that freedom is actually synonymous with book and libraries and things like that, then all of a sudden things start to click into place. And so the seven liberal arts is composed of the trivium and quadrivium. The trivium is grammar, logic, and rhetoric, specifically in that order. And the quadrivium is math, geometry, music, and astronomy, specifically in that order. And when they're taught in that order, they bring about a systematic method of learning and understanding the world that we live in via the information coming in through the five senses. And there's evidence to suggest an intentional effort to take the trivium and quadrivium away from the masses via their education since about the 1850s. The way that the current marketing systems, public relations systems, government and politics and law and all of these things, the way that they're set up now, if people had the trivium and quadrivium on a mass scale today, those things, you know, commercial television and those things, it simply wouldn't work. People wouldn't buy into all of the false rhetoric that's presented in those forms of media. So to go in real quick, the trivium is the first part of the trivium is grammar. And like I said, the trivium always has to be taught in a specific order. If it's taken out of that order, it becomes in and of itself a system of mind control. And a lot of publications on the trivium, if you look in encyclopedias and dictionaries and other publications, books and things like that, they almost always put the trivium out of order. They'll put logic first, they'll put rhetoric first, they'll put anything but grammar first. And grammar needs to be first because grammar is the parts of something, like the parts like the bricks of a building or the parts of a car or parts of a model airplane. And we have to have, you know, you can't have a finished car before you know what the parts are.
Sure,
so,
sure.
So you yep. start with the parts, right?
I think a lot of folks, maybe the context that they have for the term grammar itself is all those funny rules of
right, and
English
I'm gonna explain that here in just
great.
A second. So
great.
Grammar answers the question of who, what, where, and when. And so grammar in the trivium is also known as knowledge. And you have to have knowledge of the parts that you're dealing with, whether it's car parts or parts of a building, the bricks of a building and things to put a building together, or the parts of language. So special grammar is when it deals specifically with a language like English or Russian or Latin, whereas general grammar is when it relates to objects and reality When you're speaking them in language like tree or house or boat or tire or brick, etc., right? So general grammar is dealing with the parts of reality, and that's a big mistake with most people when they think about grammar and in fact the trivium itself is grammar is not recognized as the parts that make up reality that we put together. Okay, so as I said, grammar is who, what, where, and when of a subject, and it's discovering and ordering the facts of reality and comprises a basic systematic knowledge, not only the rules developed and applied to the ordering of word concepts for verbal expression and communication, but our first contact with conscious order as such. This is the initial self-conscious technique used in properly discursively or sequentially organizing a body of knowledge from raw factual data for the purpose of gaining understanding through logic and thus also organizing the individual human mind. And it is the foundation upon all other methods of organization and order. So that's what that's what grammar is, okay? And that's why grammar is always first. And then logic. And a lot of people will say, oh, logic, well, logic is bad. Logic is against reality. And there's a lot of irrationalists out there since Kant, the German philosopher. And Kant has really made a mess of reality out there. But I'm not going to go into Kant too much now, but there's a lot of information that, basically Kant would create an idea in his head and then try and hold it to reality instead of looking at the evidence coming in via the five senses, looking at the parts of grammar and then building an idea based on the available evidence. He would work backwards.
I often think of his work as being somewhat like Einstein's thought experiments, but without the math.
Well, and Einstein in many ways was a Kantian. He later renounced a lot of Kant's philosophies, but in many ways he did tread the lines of irrationality. And in fact, quantum physics is argued by many, including David Harriman, who I had on my show recently on the Gnostic Media podcast. He's written a whole book recently showing how this irrationality and Kantian philosophy and everything has created quantum physics in and of itself. And so, basically when you look at reality, you want to remove contradictions so that you can understand things. And quantum physics is the antithesis of that. Quantum physics is really allowing as many contradictions into one finite point at the same time as possible, which is against logic and reason. And so, quantum physics kind of falls into a bizarre little hole there. But for those interested, I recommend checking out David Harriman's research. Now, he does work with the Ayn Rand Institute, and so I do want to add a caveat there. And what people need to understand is you don't want to kill the messenger before you hear the message. You want to read their work and understand what is there and take what's valid and disregard what isn't valid that you can verify on your own. So
quite right.
So don't, just because somebody is Christian or Muslim or Jewish or works for the Ayn Rand Institute, don't let that be a reason not to study their work. That's irrationality in and of itself.
Quite right.
So logic is understanding, and logic is the art of non-contradictory identification, and that is actually a definition from Ayn Rand herself. And Ayn Rand, the problem with her philosophy wasn't her logic. The problem with her was that she put her logic before her grammar, and that's why she came to so many false conclusions. But her philosophy and her logic were actually very good. So if you can understand that her conclusions are wrong because she had her trivium out of order, then you can actually go in and filter out good information from her research that won't cause people like Alan Greenspan to try and bring down the country or something, right? So logic answers the why of a subject, and it is understanding. So before you have understanding of something, you have to know what you're dealing with, which is the grammar. And so you have grammar and logic, and then this comprises, well, let me read this here to you. It's developing the faculty of reason in establishing valid, i.e. non-contradictory relationships among facts yields basic systematic understanding. It is a guide for thinking correctly, for thinking without contradiction. More concisely, it is the art of non-contradictory identification. The work of logic is proof. Proof consists of establishing the truth and validity of a concept or proposition in correspondence with objective factual reality by following a self-consistent chain of higher-level thought back down to foundational primary concepts or axioms. And it means of keeping us in touch with grounded to objective reality in our search for valid knowledge and understanding. Mm. You know, and right now our whole world is taken over by irrationality, by bankers and politicians and people going crazy, working for their own self-interests.
Yes. You know,
I think there is definitely an elite factor in there as well. And, you know, I know you put your caveat at the beginning of the interview here, but with irrationality being pervasive, what has happened is basically all of these irrationalists or all of these people thinking from almost a Kantian-based philosophy have put their logic first instead of going out and gathering the proper data before they come to conclusions.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
And a lot of times this happens in the New Age movement, and I'm not going to try and attack channelers or anything like that, but you know, a lot of channelers, I think, play on thoughts that come to them and, you know, quote-unquote channelers, and without verifying anything, they pass that out to others as facts or, you know, truth in reality. Mm. And I've seen this often, you know, and what should be done at least minimally is deductive logic. You know, what I'm discussing here is in many ways inductive, but what should be done is if you come up with an idea, you know, if you have some belief about somebody, you should set out to verify that information through deductive knowledge and not just take it because you came up with the idea all of a sudden.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, and I'm not saying that telepathy and things like that don't exist because I've experienced them personally myself many dozens of times. So, you know, but you do have to find a systematic way for checking reality. You know, for instance, I do a lot of research in entheogens, also known as psychedelics, and people in the psychedelic community are known for going on a trip and thinking that everything they saw without checking it afterwards is the truth. Mm-hmm. So the trivium is something that you would want people to study before they actually took entheogens so that then they would have a systematic way of discovering fact from fiction in these visions that they have from these experiences.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
I wonder, Mr. Urban, if we might for a moment, you know, for the listeners, I think sometimes it's good to have a tangible experience or, you know, a case study to be able to point toward to, you know, to sort of provide some context or a frame of reference. And what occurred to me, what came to my mind just a bit ago as something which is an example, I think, of this failure to apply the trivium that is, you know, wide ranging, broadly impacting the American public. In 2008...
The global public, yeah.
Yeah, well, you're quite right, yes. In 2008, with the financial collapse, many of our leaders found it very popular, I think populist, to use the phrase, too big to fail, in
for
referring
sure.
to some of these financial institutions that were bailed out as well as GM.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Is that a good example, do you think, of having the trivium, you know, out of order?
Well, sure, and not only that, but, you know, these companies like AIG, et cetera, they're... You know, they're propping up the whole government. They're a part of this whole scam, right? So it's, you know, and in a quote-unquote capitalist society, as Ayn Rand actually promoted in her philosophy, that, you know, and as the Adam Smith crowd and the Austrian school of economics, they would never allow something like that to actually take place. In a free market system, if something fails, it fails, period. You don't extract billions of dollars out of the public to prop this company up that was a major cause of the problem in the first place.
Quite right.
And so anyway, let me get onto rhetoric here.
Yes.
You know, so after you've gone through grammar and logic, you get into rhetoric, and rhetoric provides the how of the subject. It's basically wisdom. And once you've studied the grammar of something or you've studied the parts of a model airplane and you've put the model airplane together, let's say you want to put an instruction manual together for somebody else or a child or whatever to put that model airplane together also. Well, the rhetoric aspect is that manual, that explanation of how to do it, whether written or verbal, of you explaining how something was done. The rhetoric aspect is it me explaining how the trivium works here after going through the grammar and logic aspects. So, you know, and a lot of people do some aspects of this automatically in their daily thinking, but recognizing that there is a systematic process to it allows the mind to start thinking more clearly and properly, and also we begin to notice false logic in our thinking, and we can begin to remove false logic, also known as fallacies, logical fallacies, or fallare, mm-hmm. which is basically lies. Mm-hmm. So once we understand how these things work, how the mind works, then we can begin to spot false reasoning and remove the false reasoning from our own thinking before we pass bad information on to others, or before we spread, for instance, a virus onto somebody else. Just like if you get, you know, some crazy email from somebody and you don't check it first and you send it on to other people, and all of a sudden you realize you've sent a virus on to 20 or 30 of your friends and you've mm-hmm. infected their computers, they're not going to be really happy with you. Well, in our society, people do almost nothing to make sure that they have a mental antivirus system to filter their thoughts before passing information on to others, just like in the computer world. And so the trivium acts as that mental antivirus system to catch the false thoughts, to make sure that you verified thoughts and ideas before you pass them on to others. You know, if you get some one of those chain emails that says, if you sit on a toilet, you know, look out, spiders are hiding on the toilets, and you don't go on snoops.com or whatever real quick and check it out, you're doing everybody a disfavor. You're wasting everybody's time when you do that you send it to, and you're sending out a virus. You're sending out false information. So rather than sending out that information, take a few seconds or a few minutes to verify it. And usually the time that you spend to verify something, it will save far more time down the road, not only for yourself, but for others. So, you know, don't be so selfish. Take a few minutes to verify that the information is valid before you send it on. And another thing that I like to, you know, they'll see people often do all over the place. I think that the Zeitgeist movement is in large part a mind control socialist system. And I'm not a big fan of Zeitgeist, but Zeitgeist Part 1, in the part where he went into astrotheology, I've done a lot of research on astrotheology over the last decade, and there is substantial evidence to support it in the academic journals, in university publications and things like that, ancient primary texts that I myself have published. But if you go online and you read the attacks of Zeitgeist 1, Part 1, you'll see all of these people attacking, for instance, Acharya S. or D.M. Murdoch and the whole theory of astrotheology, saying that it's completely a theosophist, Fabian socialist creation that came out of the 1800s. There's no evidence for it whatsoever. But if you look at all of these claims, none of these people have actually read Acharya's books or the other books that they attack, like Gerald Macy and some of these other people. So you have to pay attention to that stuff. Mm-hmm. And not only that, are they saying, oh, well, she's just a disinformationist. Well, this is an ad hominem attack or a logical fallacy. They're saying Acharya is a fraud or something like that. I'm just using these as examples, right, because I see them all over the place.
Sure.
So that is an ad hominem attack, and that should alert you right away to know that, well, okay, this person, and rather than dealing with the evidence, they're attacking the man, or in this case, the woman. Mm-hmm. And so they don't want to deal with the specific evidence. So what they're doing is they're diverting attention away from that evidence on to questioning the integrity of the person instead.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what we have to do is recognize this as false logic and go back to the work itself. And then when you end up actually reading Acharya's books, all four or five of her books yourself, you'll discover that she's got dozens of ancient primary citations and things in there that you would only find if you actually spent, you know, time reading her books or going to a university library and looking through the academic journals. Yes. And so, you know, people will go online and they'll do a Wikipedia search or they'll do a Google search, But if you look in her books, those aren't the citations that she's using. So by not using her citations, what you're doing in effect is you're creating a straw man argument. Okay, and a straw man argument is when you set up an argument that looks like the person's original argument, but what you do is you change things like the citations or whatever, and then you present that argument and pretend that that's the original argument. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a very common practice. So, you know, again, you have to go back and look at the author's research, look at their citations, and go look at those citations at what the evidence is exactly. Any other means of doing so is false logic. It's lying, okay?
Quite
so,
right.
You know, if I say that, you know, if you go down to Walmart, you can go buy a gallon of organic milk there, and then somebody else comes along and says, I was just down at 7-Eleven, and there is no organic milk there. What the heck are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense at all?
None.
So why would it make sense for somebody to go on Wikipedia or Google or somewhere else to look for research that is pointed out in exactly opposite direction of what they claim, right? So it makes no sense. It's just lies.
Right.
So this is the kind of false logic or things that people do. And I haven't even had a chance to get into the quadrivium, but I do want to cover a few more logical fallacies, because the logical fallacies themselves are very important for people to understand, because they can begin to apply them right away in daily reality and see how mind control systems work and the media and things like that. And once you start understanding logical fallacies, and once you learn the names of the logical fallacies, which is very important, because what happens is when you know the logical fallacies and understand how to identify them, you take your knowledge from implicit to explicit. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is that, let's say you go to a car dealership and you're talking to the car dealer and he says, you know, Tony, if you buy this car, you're going to get all the girls, and, you know, this car comes with this and that. And, you know, I have this funny feeling that this guy is lying to me. I'm not quite sure what. Well, that's implicit. Well, if you say, you know, the explicit knowledge of that would be, well, he just used an appeal to emotion on me, an appeal to flattery, an appeal to popularity, and getting on the bandwagon, I'm going to have all these pretty girls and all these things. So suddenly you have the specific names of the types of lies that he used against you.
Yes.
So
yes.
Then it takes it to explicit understanding or explicit knowledge of what just happened. So you're no longer left with just that funny feeling.
Yes, it's an awareness, I think, of the specific tactics or techniques,
right,
if you will.
Remember what I said, that logic is the art of non-contradictory identification. So what you're doing is you're identifying the specific lies. Now, a lot of people will say, oh, well, logic, I don't want to identify things, I don't want to know things, but that is irrationality. You cannot communicate effectively if you don't know the names or the identification of things. What are you going to say? Go over there and get the whatchamacallit, right?
You right.
Know, and somebody says, okay, so whatchamacallit, you're wasting my time here. Oh, well, it's the eraser right there underneath your left hand. And then suddenly we're communicating effectively. We're not wasting each other's time. We're not sending out a bunch of noise.
Mm-hmm.
And noise, like in a radio signal, is distortion, and noise and logic are the fallacies.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So, and there's a lot more. I already gave you the straw man fallacy, the ad hominem, a couple
of
the.
In fact, you have. I'm not sure if it is your own work or if you can point to that work. It's the pop up video.
Thanks for mentioning that. I do run another website aside from GnosticMedia.com. Actually, a few more websites. But
please share.
People will be interested in PopUpFallacies.com, and they can find that through the Gnostic Media website on the links down on the left there as well. But also I recommend people that want to learn more about what I'm discussing, the Trivium, to go to triviumeducation.com. That's TRIVIUM.com. And all of this information that we're covering is up on the website, including the logical fallacies. There's videos and audio that they can check out up there. So that's a good place for people to start there.
Tremendous.
And so let's cover some more of these fallacies, though. And I mentioned appeal to ridicule. Well, I didn't mention that one. Appeal to ridicule is, let's say I say that the Illuminati are running a lot of things going on in the world. And actually, you know, the Illuminati, if you look in any old early 1900s dictionary or encyclopedia, you'll see the Illuminati well discussed there. The facts of the Illuminati are pretty well discussed in any history book, etc. But a lot of people say, oh, well, it's just this Illuminati conspiracy theory. But even though it's been well proved, and even though that many of their plans that were written out have actually taken place in society, what they'll do is they'll come off with an appeal to ridicule, like, you know, you're ridiculous, you're a conspiracy theorist, that's stupid, ha, 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 ha. So right, what an appeal to ridicule is you're wrong because ha, 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 ha.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. That's all it is. That's their reasoning. So it's, and it falls under the ad hominem as well. As you know, it's just like, you're a conspiracy theorist, you're a nut, you're a loony, appeal to ridicule, oh, I'm supposed to believe that, oh, why don't I just put on a tinfoil hat, ha, 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 which is also a red herring, because we're not, you know, talking about tinfoil hats or anything. So you keep people focused on what you're discussing instead of letting them derail your conversation all over the place onto irrelevant topics like tinfoil hats and things like that, and you keep the conversation focused.
Quite right.
So there's poisoning the well, which is, let's say if I get a point wrong in one of my books, and they'll say that because this single point is wrong, my entire book is wrong. Or because this single point is wrong, everything in all of my books and all of my work is wrong. That's known as poisoning the well. You have to look at each point individually on its own merit.
Sure.
Misleading vividness, personal attacks, there's the post hoc. A black cat crossed my path today. Tomorrow I get in a car accident. That's the post hoc fallacy. It's, you know, this happened before, so therefore that happened. It's a false cause and effect.
Yes.
And the red herring is a very interesting fallacy and a very commonly used one. And maybe we can do maybe one more after this. But red herring is when I am talking about, let's say, the trivium, and you bring up an entirely irrelevant discussion and try and make it look as it's relevant to the trivium, and then we abandon the discussion of the trivium for this other topic, right? Mm-hmm. And politicians do this stuff all the time. You ask a politician a pointed question, and he'll go off into some story about something else. This is an intentional tactic called the red herring. And
yes.
Then the person will be left scratching their head going, did he really just answer my question? But no. So if you can catch the politician doing that tactic, you can call them out. You know, why don't, that's not what my question was. That's a red herring. Would you stick to the question, please?
Yes.
And, you know, and let's be specific. I don't need your false rhetoric today. Let's not waste any time here.
Mm-hmm.
So where the red herring comes from is back in the fox and hound hunting, or, you know, the hound hunting the fox days. What they would do when they were training the fox, or training the hound to hunt the fox, is they would, when they were testing the hound to make sure that it was ready to put into full use, for lack of a better word, they would have a fox go out, and then what they would do is, as the hound was hunting the fox, they would take a fish and they would drag it across the fox's trail to try to lead the hound on to the scent of the herring instead. Okay, so this is where we get the concept of red herring from.
Sure.
Taking you off the trail of the original topic onto another side topic. Another one that politicians like to use is slippery slope. Oh, if you legalize marijuana, people will be shooting heroin and snorting cocaine in the streets tomorrow.
Indeed.
You know, this is just complete nonsense. There's no reason to suggest whatsoever that legalizing marijuana would cause any other thing. And in fact, Holland and these other countries that have legalized it have had a sharp decrease in drug use in their local populations.
Right.
12-year-olds in Amsterdam don't like to smoke marijuana, and they're one of the highest using groups in the United States. So
quite right. Well, Mr. Urban, I apologize to have to interrupt, and unfortunately we are up against it in the time that we have left today, so I'm afraid we'll have to cut short our conversation. I am just terribly, terribly fascinated by your work. I absolutely encourage the listeners to go to www.gnosticmedia.com. That's Gnostic, G-N-O-S-T-I-C, media.com. And also, for more of their own homework about the subjects that we've just been talking about, these fallacies, I definitely encourage folks to go to it. Help me understand again. It's popupfallacies.com?
Yeah, popupfallacies.com. And it's popupfallacies.com.
Excellent.
And they can get, if they go to the Trivium Education website, they'll find that right there on the top as well.
Excellent. Excellent. Mr. Urban, I'm so sorry that we're short on time today, but I want you to know how very much impactful I find your work to be, your research, and the quality of your thinking. I thank you so very much for your time today, and I certainly hope we could continue our conversation at some time in the future.
Sure, not a problem. And would you do me a favor and send me a recording of the interview as well?
Absolutely. You'll have it just as soon as it's prepared.
All right. Thank you so much.
Very good. Thank you again. And folks, tune in next week for the Crimson Pill, where we'll continue our exploration into some of these subjects that are affecting us in so many ways all around the world every single day. Thanks again so much. Bye-bye.